Welcome to the Enduring Curiosity Podcast. I am your host, Greg Outer. Join us as we seek solutions to the challenges facing our world today. Through curiosity, we can forge a resilient future for all life on this planet. And welcome back. We are excited to bring you an incredible lineup this fall. This week, I'm thrilled to welcome Jonathan DeLong to the show. Jonathan is the executive director and co-founder of the REAP Center for Regeneration, Education, Aquaculture, and Permaculture in Alameda, California. Jonathan is also a startup veteran, big problem solver, systems wizard, and fellow member of the Sustainable Ocean Alliance. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me. That is quite an intro. It makes me happy to hear it.
Well, awesome. Awesome. I'm thrilled to have you here. One of the big reasons I'm excited to lead off this half of the season with you is you've described yourself as an optimist, and I feel like we need to hear the voices of optimists more, because most of the voices that we hear seem to come through people who describe themselves as realists or pessimists or skeptics or whatever. So I'm curious, where does this optimism come from, and how do you channel that through your work?
I mean, that is a good question. I feel like I've lived a lot of lives, and I've got a lot of experiences. And what I've learned mostly is that, you know, I don't know anything, and I like to approach all things in that way. And in approaching things in that way, I open myself up to hearing amazing stories from experts around me. And I am constantly enamored by all that is possible. And I like to look around at our natural environment and our built environment and think that, you know, none of this largely was here. It was all optimism at one point. And so knowing that we, through optimism and leaning on experts and collaboration, can create really mind-boggling things, that leads me to believe that we can find our way out of the calamity that we may be in from an environmental, economic, social, racial perspective in our country and the world today.
So that leads me into something I thought we'd be talking about a little bit later, but this is the perfect jumping off point for it. In our previous conversation, we talked about what you call the myth of permanence and the idea that for some reason we hold that things that are, have always been, and have always, or always will be. How has better understanding that to be a myth shaped not only kind of how you've gotten to where you are, but in how you approach problem solving?
Yeah. I like that question too. Thank you. The myth of permanence, the way I phrase it, at least the way it's manifested in my mind, is really anchored in context. And I look at that sometimes in relationship to how many people think that the human experience and the natural experience are these two separate paradigms that don't exist in construct, that we, you know, are somehow separate from nature. And I think what that allows us to do is break the timeline, break the context with the cycles that are occurring around us in the natural world. And so we may think something's permanent. It might be a stone or a piece of metal or a building, or it might be something political or some social construct. But in the context of the natural environment, many of these things are just a blip in time. And so the idea that we can create things around us and the Earth's processes aren't going to have dramatic effects on them over time means that we really just haven't considered context in the natural systems and the timelines that we're living in. And so what I like to do as I'm approaching problem solving, either from a relationship or in relationship to nature or policy, is to really stretch out those timelines the best that we can and acknowledge that all these things that we built around us have the potential to crumble. And maybe we surrender to that, you know, much like, you know, migrating sand dunes or islands otherwise.
You mentioned systems in that answer, and I'm really interested in how you first became exposed to systems and how kind of beginning to look at the world as these closed loop systems and as these ecological systems as well may have transformed the way that you see everything around you and the way that you approach problems within that.
you know, I think for longer than I can remember, I've believed that all things are connected in one way or another, to some small degree, and often beyond our ability to perceive them, right? All things are connected in our ecosystems between the land and the sea and the air. And, you know, as I learned more about that, I started getting exposed to a lot of design science thinking, like through institutes like the Buckminster Fuller Institute and many, many others, too many to list. And I became fascinated at trying to understand the relationship between all of these things and how, by balancing systems, we can embrace the abundance that nature has to offer. The planet has the ability to feed all people. The things that don't work in that context is the systems that we've created. And that is actually super exciting. Back to optimism, it means that we have the opportunity to change and improve these things. But just understanding the delicate balance between the land and the ocean is really where my systems thinking transitioned me into soil science, because I started looking at a lot of the problems in the ocean and tried to figure out how do we solve them through smarter policy decisions or through conservation or education. And I realized that many of the things we're actually trying to solve for originated on the land. And so there's this vast thing, the ocean, right? All one body of water, right? But it has the ability to be affected by, you know, minor decisions that might be thousands of miles inland. And so that base understanding of systems thinking is what drew me into realizing, wait, there are levers to pull. Again, back to Buckminster Fuller, who said, you know, there's the idea of a trim tab on an airplane, this little thing you can turn a tiny bit to affect massive change in direction and steering. What are those trim tabs that exist, you know, around us today, whether they're, again, back to policy? I'll talk a lot about policy because I think that smart policy can shape the natural world in amazing ways. But what are those elements within these larger systems that we can make a relatively small change and have a dramatic effect? Because right now we need to have a dramatic effect. And in the context of the time that's before us, we need to do those things soon. So what are the small things that we can do that have massive change? And that really ties into systems. To diverge just a little bit, when I think about systems too, I think about how we've also made the decision as a species to ignore the relationship between these systems. You know, if you look at economic models in very simple terms, we have the idea of externalities, right? And the thought that human health and planetary health are an externality that can't be figured out in the equation of these economic models and therefore can just be dismissed and put aside, made sense at one time, right? We didn't have the machine learning, the AI, the data processing to be able to understand the relationships between economic and ecological effects. But we do now. We can tie these things together. And so now, again, it's back to policy. Do we choose to tie these things out together? And so there's a couple of things that I'm super optimistic about that I see happening around us these days. And one of those is the Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures. And I know that's getting super wonky out of the blue here, but really it's now saying that, hey, listen, huge asset managers with many trillions of assets under management globally have a financial obligation to disclose carbon risk. And that could be risk related to transition, meaning, hey, you make a widget and it's only works on an oil platform. And well, oil platforms are going out of style, so you better disclose that to your investors. Or whether it's built risk, hey, we only have a portfolio of high rises in Miami, well, and it's on the beach, well, you better disclose that as a carbon related financial risk. And so now you see, you know, these huge asset managers really kind of scrambling to keep essentially a separate book set to say, okay, well, we've got our regular financials, and now we've got our carbon related financials for disclosures. And so we're starting to see those big elements tying together these things that were thought to be externalities in the past. And for me, this is really the systems approach to understanding the relationship. Well, coming down the pipe is another similar sort of approach. And I might get the name wrong. I believe it's the Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures. And so that's really now tied to biodiversity, opposed to, say, carbon, which is the last one I talked about. And if you look at biodiversity-related financial disclosures, you may be a railroad or really a bank financing a railroad being built into the Amazon whose sole purpose is to remove trees. Well, you're going to have a net effect on biodiversity. And you now, if these things move down the pipe, are going to have to disclose that to your investors and to the world. And so what we're starting to see is the tying together of these huge financial mechanisms with this understanding of the effect of carbon and the cost of carbon, the risk of carbon, and then biodiversity. And so I'm super excited to see these really high level kind of wonky things that are shifting structurally across how we as a species really view our disclosures and our decision-making. And to me, that comes back down to systems, because now if we look at that, again, back to the world that I exist in today, which is really related to biodiversity and soil, now we can start to say, hey, what are we doing that might have a negative impact on biodiversity to soil? And how must that be disclosed? And does that disclosure expose us in some way and give us the opportunity to change our behavior here? So again, a really long answer to your systems approach, but that's how my mind is approaching it. And you know, some might do it differently, but that's all I have.
Absolutely. And that seems like such a departure from the way we've been doing things for so long. And it seems like policy often lags behind in these broad philosophical shifts that we see and problem-solving shifts that we see. What are some of the main things that are holding back the whether it's thought or philosophy or practice on the policy side, and what are things that are needed on that side to be able to catch up, to be able to appropriately address these rapid systemic changes that are happening that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, I think it's always, you know, kind of back to context and setting the right goals. But before I get into context and setting the right goals, I run into a lot of people who are completely overwhelmed by climate-related challenges. And for that matter, again, we can tie into other challenges, social, racial, environmental, but climate-related challenges specifically, because so many people are overwhelmed, they think there's no way we can make a change here. But the truth is, per your policy question, it's down to a matter of will. You know, will we decide to make the changes that we need to make the enhancements and improvements to the ways we do things that actually can bring all people forward in line and in sync with nature, right? So that's just one thing. But you said what specifically needs to change. And I think it maybe helps to tell you a story or give you an example that gets me excited about soil and soil science. And again, we'll get into this, I'm sure, in more detail. So I hope I'm not jumping ahead. But you know, with the work I do with the REAP Center, you know, our mandate, our focus as a 501c3 is to further the awareness, the art, science, technology, and policy is related to biodiversity and soil. And biodiversity and soil rolls up to, you know, two, but really three really exciting and important elements. And one is the ability for soil to sequester, you know, more carbon, if you look at it from, you know, doing proper soils work and soil science with, you know, ag land, we can sequester more carbon in the soil within one generation that we have ever released into the atmosphere as a species. I mean, that is an incredibly exciting opportunity and thing to say in the context of carbon challenges, right? The other is, you know, when you have healthy soil, you have healthy people. You know, having an abundance of microbes, to keep it simple, having an abundance of healthy microbes in the soil actually provides the nutrition to enhance human health on Earth and affects positive change in healthcare and all sorts of other things. And so, you know, those two things get me really excited about the soil science. And I want to focus for a second for your question on the enhanced nutrition for humans. And it's about goal setting. Well, there's an organization that we hope to create deeper partnerships with at the REAP Center, which is the Bionutrient Institute, really also, you know, same institute, but the Bionutrient Food Association. And what they've done is super exciting. They have created a handheld spectrometer. And this is normally a device that, you know, traditionally only exists in, you know, huge laboratories and universities, right, where you can measure the nutrition in food, right? You can actually hold this device up to a carrot, you know, and hold it up to another carrot. And you can tell the nutritional difference between the two. Well, they've actually taken this device and they've shrunk it down so it can fit in your pocket. So you can now walk into a store, and a lot of people don't realize that one carrot versus the other carrot might have 90 times more nutritional value than the others, right? This is mind-blowing to some people because they think, well, I'm eating a carrot, I'm doing a healthy thing. Except understanding the difference between the output of food and the value that it has in relationship to the goal at hand, feeding and nourishing people. And now we have the tools to do that at scale. And why do I say that in relationship to your policy question? Well, we, you know, give out subsidy to farmers, you know, based on the weight yield of crop. Well, the weight yield is, again, it was an approximation of nutrition, and it comes from old models that are really outdated. So if we do the right goal setting, which really is related to policy and aiming for the right targets, we can actually affect the change we need to see, which is feeding people, which is healing our planet. So again, moving that tiny policy decision away, don't take away, you know, ag subsidy. It's super important. It's how our mechanisms work. There's a lot of economies that would crash. There's families and places in the country that would suffer if we, you know, took away, you know, ag subsidy as it exists today. But if you just create one higher level, right, a bigger carrot, a bigger bonus, you know, based on the nutritional yield of the crop, then we start to put in those trim tab elements that can shift huge changes. And the reason I talk about that from a subsidy standpoint is because the only way to get to that higher level target, to that higher nutritional output, is through healthy soil practices. And so that's why those high level subsidy things matter to me in our mandate to focus on biodiversity and soil, because the only way to get there is through healthy soil practices and all the chains that operate between those two. And there are, you know, many small policy decisions like that we can make today that can have a huge effect on climate and carbon and human health and planetary health.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get into that. Let's start with that then. So what specifically is the REAP Center, and how is and what is it attempting to do with the land that you're reclaiming?
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Well, you know, we are trying to restore some land, and we're trying to make it available to all people. You know, when you say reclaiming, I get nervous because it makes it sound like somehow, you know, a small number of people are getting things, but helping nature to reclaim some land, I think, is a better way to look at it for us. But the REAP Center, with its, you know, fun acronym of, you know, regeneration, education, aquaculture, and permaculture, you know, with our mandate for biodiversity and soil, we are on old railroad land. It's a half mile long, so it's quite a bit, and it's on an island in, you know, on Alameda in the middle of the San Francisco Bay. So it's this really sort of unique thing. And what we are doing is trying to create a whimsical, fun environment for adults and kids to come and experience soil and soil science in a way that they can actually, you know, literally and metaphorically get their hands dirty. And across this body of land, we're hoping to put in, and we're doing some of this now, we're only in our first year of the project, a edible park and sculpture garden, which is really a food forest, showing that nature can be abundant and pumping and open to the public, where people can walk through and pick what they need. A whimsical area for soil labs, which involve, you know, six different types of composting demonstrations to show how we can convert, you know, things that are traditionally thought about as food waste or waste in our society into, you know, usable elements to help rebuild soil, which obviously can contribute to all the things we talked about. And then elements of that in a fun, playful way that really will attract, you know, kids and, again, adults and scientists that want to participate in things like our worm world and our fermentation station or our fungi hut, our hydrology house, and all these things that really break down in an approachable way the elements of soil. And then a permaculture community garden. So not the traditional community garden where you have, you know, separate beds, there's Bob's tomatoes and Sally's cucumbers, which is not how nature works, right? We want to help people understand there's overlapping interdependent ecosystems that are as much about how do we get along with each other. And then a really big element to the project is a makerspace. So a place that people can come and tinker with shared elements like, you know, a shared wood shop and metal shop and robotics lab and things along those lines, where they can actually work on the art, science, technology, and policy related to biodiversity and soil and all that fun stuff that rolls up from there. And then hopefully within that space, we'll be able to incubate and accelerate small teams and companies that actually want to roll out and take these things to commercial scale. But back to the backdrop of the property itself, it's, you know, again, it's a half mile long, it's old railroad land. And just a couple of days ago, we had a massive rain event, and across this property, you know, 7 inches of rain fell in under 24 hours. That's quite a bit of rainfall in and of itself. And as I mentioned, it's our first year of being on the property. So I'm still learning, you know, what are the annual flows of this property? And, you know, we are fairly low lying. We are in a floodplain, but, you know, we're above, you know, what would be, you know, often floods, but this is a place to receive some of the pressures of, you know, it's the relationship between the land and the sea. But what I realized during this rain event is not only did we have a lot of rainfall in this one place that is this hard, compacted land, which doesn't have the resilience, the ability to absorb and hold water, but also we were receiving the effect of, you know, policy decisions by, you know, City and Public Works over, you know, many, many generations that have said, where do we put water? We've got to get rid of water. And so they chose this land as a place to let it run off to, right or wrong. And, you know, there's no liability or conversation around that here. For me, it's just like, you know, I'm fascinated to learn, like, what led to us having, you know, a foot and a half of water in most of this place for, you know, a stretch of time. And what I realize is it's the intersection of these two paradigms that I'm talking about, which is, how do we look at taking soil and making it healthy, you know, across a large area so that it's expansive and can hold water that comes, because we want to use it for many months to come, right? And make it accessible. And then also, what is the paradigm of how we look at the concept of a watershed? You know, there's many cultures around the world that don't even have that idea. The idea that you want to shed water doesn't make sense. But in a lot of, you know, Western development in the built environment, we think about, how do we get water away as quickly as possible, you know, and what does that do? Well, it sends toxins and other things into the ocean. And so, you know, here we are, you know, in the first year of this project, trying to, you know, heal this land and find ways to help it expand, to hold water. And meanwhile, we're receiving, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons of water, you know, running off from streets and parking lots and nearby areas, where it's really the blending of these two things. And so, you know, here I am, you know, somebody who worked in, you know, land use consulting and development in the past, you know, beyond my work in policy and technology. And I started trying to say, how do we never let this happen again? Like, how do I mitigate this, you know? And I found my brain breaking a little bit, because I was trying to balance these two things, because, you know, the person running a science center for soil health, I'm thinking, you know, how do we make soil expansive? How do we capture this water from a permaculture perspective? I'm thinking, how do we store this water and use it for dry periods in the future? But as somebody who's carrying all of this legacy, you know, construct in, I'm like, how do we get rid of it? You know, how do we pump it away? And, you know, how do I close those drains coming from the city, so we don't, you know, how do I build a curb, and, you know, all of these things. So what I'm realizing within myself is the journey that I hope that we all go on as a species, which is rethinking about our relationship with land and changing how we look at, you know, what do we do with water? How do we keep soil in and land healthy enough to be resilient to handle these events, right? And it's not going to be through the built environment, right? It's going to be using regenerative processes. And there's another organization that I really, really like, which is the Biomimicry Institute, right? And you know, as a former technologist, or as a lifelong technologist, I don't know, you know, what I realized is, when we would build technology, when we build software systems, you know, the real expensive part of that is often in the QA, right? It's in the, you know, how do we check for bugs after the fact, you know, and that might cost as much as building the tech in the first place. But if you look at, you know, these things, and again, problem solving for the water event we just talked about, and you look at the Biomimicry Institute, well, their question is, you know, how would nature solve this problem? You know, and then how do we mimic it? And the great news is, nature is technology, and the QA has been done over millennia. And so the really expensive part has already been done for us, and the blueprints are there if we stop to look at it. And then in the construct of regeneration, and just for those who aren't used to that phrase, and it's, you know, sort of new to me as well, you know, there's the idea of degeneration, right? And so we thought, well, we'll answer that with sustainability. Well, sustainability, we might have missed the mark on that in some areas, or we've missed the window. And so then the question is, what's next? And regeneration is what is next. And it's, how do we look at the natural environment, and how do we mimic nature to regenerate systems around us and use that as our roadmap for problem solving? And so back to the rain event, you know, and I sent you a picture earlier today where I'm, you know, kind of kayaking down our driveway. How would nature solve this problem is where I have now landed around, what do we do to prepare for the next rain event like this? And how can we then pass on those lessons to municipalities and policymakers and other people to do the same?
Absolutely. And I think that experience of dealing with water in a more harmonious way is going to be an issue that's facing a lot of coastal communities as well. I know that's one of the big things that we're working on here in Charleston, South Carolina. So you brought up the difference between regeneration and sustainability there, and that was one of the things here on the list that I was really hoping to get a little bit more into depth with you on here, because that's I think we often, at least in everyday life, see people maybe confusing conservation with sustainability. And now we're going to throw this new term at them, which is regeneration. What is the difference between these three very different approaches to working with nature, and what makes regeneration that much more applicable to the context that we're going to be facing in the near future?
Yeah. I look at regeneration as the ultimate goal in the context of harmony with nature and natural systems. But I guess I'll focus on sustainability. First of all those people out there working on sustainable projects today, don't stop. Please don't change that mindset. Keep doing those things. Be looking at, you know, every decision we make to say, is this something that if we continue to do, will it be healthy for humans and the planet over time? And if not, let's look at another way of doing it. But in the construct of regeneration in the natural world, the question is, are we creating, or more importantly, supporting the likelihood for nature to be able to regrow itself in a healthy way, which can enhance abundance and nutrition for humans and planetary health and all of these other things? Sustainability is largely, how do we make sure that what we're doing doesn't change over time, that it preserves the existing conditions and paradigms? Well, you know, if you look around, there's a lot of existing conditions and paradigms that we do not want to preserve. In fact, these are the paths that will lead to greater calamity over time. And so rather than just say, oh, you know, all is lost, let's give up and throw our hands in the air, which, you know, some people do, the question is, what's next? And it's, how do we look to the natural environment to support regenerative processes, the ability to regrow the natural environment in a way that's healthy, whether that's looking to supporting decisions on land that actually help reefs regrow in the ocean, whether that's making sure that we have the resilience within our own bodies to fend off future pandemics and things that come. Are we creating healthy communities, right, that help us overall? What are the things that we can do that support the conditions in which nature can regenerate herself? And we are part of nature.
And let's expand on that a little bit further. How does that lead to environmental justice and community resilience if we're beginning to adopt more regenerative practices?
Ooh, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack in there. I believe that social, racial, and environmental justice are all the same issue. It's the same topic. They all end at the same point. And that if we don't look at these things in concert, that we'll forever be chasing one at the loss of the other, and none will be successful. We can't get ourselves ahead of these things unless we all try to move these things down the pipe. You know, if you look at environmental harm, right, over time, it you know, often it means that there was a population or an area, which normally houses a population, that had to be left out. It was a zero-sum game, you know? And so for us to, you know, make something on this one side, this other side had to have a loss, and well, that's just how it goes. There's winners and there's losers, right? And this is a mindset that still persists today in many ways that blows my mind, opposed to saying, how do we create harmony between all of these different relationships, communities, ecosystems, environments? And so when I started to become aware, and again, I'm still a student of all of these things. I'm not here because I know the answers. I'm here because I'm seeking to learn more. That often those who are harmed through poor environmental policy and decisions are also those who are most at risk in our society because of other inequities that have existed financially, racially, you know, socially. And so by having smart environmental policy, again, because my lens is through the lens of environment, right? By having smart environmental policy, we have this amazing ability to like spend the same dollar, you know, 3, 4, or 5 times, because by making a smart choice here, we can actually improve all these other things across the board. Right. The same goes otherwise, right? When you give, if you look at social justice movements, right, when more people have a voice, there are more people contributing to the policies that affect our national environment. And by and large, you know, the masses do some pretty stupid things, right? But the masses also collectively largely know what makes sense for their communities and for their health, and often lean into those when they're empowered to do so. And so I look at the empowerment of people. I look at including as many voices and perspectives into the political process, into our social experiment as a species as possible, being helpful to the environment as well. And so all of these things for me, they start to tie together in ways that I'm only barely beginning to understand. And there's a lot of really smart people doing really great work on this. And maybe we can put some links in the show notes.
I love that. I love how the multidisciplinary nature of what you're talking about can lead to this ripple effect of positive benefits from that. I think that's incredible. So let's talk about soil health for a moment and rebuilding that. It seems like soil is too often the forgotten part of the larger puzzle. We talk about trees, we talk about our estuaries, we talk about coral, we talk about fisheries even, but until very recently, soil hasn't been as much a part of that conversation. Why do you think that is?
Yeah. It's a great question, and I think I should, you know, mention here now just on the offset, you know, I'm not a scientist, right? I'm a citizen scientist. I'm a curious person. It might be why you've invited me here today. You know, one of the reasons I helped found the REAP Center is because I became so incredibly fascinated by the power of soil. I kept wanting to learn more. And then I realized, and through, you know, dumb luck and opportunity and maybe some ambition, I found the opportunity to help grow a place that other people can come and learn and teach about these things. So I am a student in this, you know, full stop. But that being said, I come from a policy and a technology background. Some of these things done at quite large scale related to affordable housing subsidy streams, related to, you know, large tech projects with, you know, AT&T and others. So I tend to think in terms of scale. And as I started looking around for where could I be helpful with climate, I started looking around to say, where are there scalable solutions that can be implemented by many, many people, not just one, you know, savior coming down and creating that ultimate technology that's going to do all the things we need. But, you know, what is that element that's scalable? And soil really emerged to me as, hey, it's simple, it's straightforward, it's scalable, it's abundant, and it's something that we all can contribute towards. And so, first of all, and I know this might be simple to a lot of people, but, you know, a couple of years ago, my mind was kind of blown when I finally really realized that, wait, soil is alive. It's a living element. And then once I started thinking, I was like, no, wait, soil is alive. But I thought soil and dirt were the same thing. And no, that's not the case. You know, dirt is sort of, you know, dead soil. It can't retain the water. It can't support life. And so, you know, what does it mean when you have living soil? And what are all the elements of living soil that go ahead and roll up to carbon sequestration or enhanced nutrition for humans? And so for me, soil and soil science just became this foundational element that was scalable in terms of, you know, something that we could use as a tool to help the greatest number of people.
And just kind of continuing on that, I think it's worth mentioning again that the name of the center is based on regeneration, education, aquaculture, permaculture, all these different elements working together and fitting into one shared experience where you're addressing all these different issues in one shared space. So let's get into goals by having all of these different ideas, different opportunities under one umbrella in this one lab, so to speak. What are you hoping to show the surrounding community?
The only way to really answer that is by first saying, you know, what is the surrounding community? And then I realized that the surrounding community is near and far, that the work we do locally, creating resilience, and that's people being a part of the process politically, it's people being a part of the process scientifically. It's about having a place that people can come and learn together. You end up in where we can grow our own food, and we can raise the bar for nutrition and human health. That these are all elements that exist locally. But by fostering that locally, we also can contribute collectively to art, science, technology, and policy, which further these things and actually can have planetary effects. And again, so that's this idea that all things are related. So, you know, I wanted to be a part of a team bringing together all of these elements so that we can invite as many people into the conversation as possible to be experiential learners. You know, I'm dyslexic, and traditional, you know, education was challenging for me as I moved through college and other places I've learned over time. And what I keep coming back to is I learn best by being a part of a community, by getting my hands into it, by actually watching these things happen, observing the change. And in doing so, I found better resilience in my own life. And so what I get most excited about is as the center grows and I'm, you know, looking out on a volunteer day and there's kids getting their community service hours from Alameda high schools, working alongside, you know, engineers and PhDs from MIT and Stanford, bringing together this collection of mindset is incredibly inspiring. And I think it's only by joining this collection of mindset that we will get ahead of these things. The other part is, you know, I am an optimist. I do believe that we can affect change. I do believe we have to do this in a timely manner. And there's a lot of young people I talk to. And I should say first, I believe in higher education. Go off, get a higher degree, you know, do all those things. I do also know there's a lot of young people out there who, when they start to play out the timeline of the how long they've been around on Earth and the calamity that they see around them, the idea of going off for, you know, 8, 12, 16 years of schooling to then maybe come in at entry level to then maybe have an effect on change, it doesn't jive with the context of the timelines that is around us. And so there's a lot of young folks who are looking for a way to make a change today. And so I was hoping to create an environment where young people can be brought in and work alongside people with advanced degrees in these fields, where we can then get out of their way, that they can go off and start making a change today that they feel they need to see in the world. And so for me, bringing in the education and an adult and a youth level, right, bringing in an accelerator and incubator for youth through PhD programs, bringing in elements where there's really high level science going on in an approachable way where we can still have summer camps and kids coming in and playing with microscopes and working with the compost. Having all these elements together for me just makes sense. And at the end of the day, even if we somehow don't ever achieve our planetary objectives that we have, which is, you know, gigaton level carbon sequestration, which is enhanced nutrition for humans, right, as a nonprofit, if the fallback position is that we created resilience at a community level through art, science, technology, and policy, then we've at least won something. And so maybe I'm hedging my bets, or maybe it's a systems approach. I don't know.
It all works, though. It all is going to create some very important and very meaningful benefits in the end, whichever of those, you know, whether it's the hedged bet there or it's the fully ambitious realization of the dream. So I'd love to push a little bit further on the young people and the local kind of grassroots message that you're saying there. How scalable do y'all intend to be? Do you intend to focus locally, or do you see yourself either partnering with or expanding beyond where you are today?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm asked that a lot in various capacities. You know, I want to restate that we are in our first year of existence as a young nonprofit. We've gone real far, real fast. It's mind-boggling the pace at which we have moved, and we've raised some real money through generous individuals. We're moving into some grants programs. We're bringing together local leaders to help with this. Things are moving real fast. It's great. So I don't want to discount all that we've done and where we are today. We have, you know, we've had, you know, hundreds of volunteers come through. It's so exciting. And like when I start saying these things out loud, it takes my breath away. That being said, the model that we are creating has the ability to scale and roll out to different parts of the country and the world. You know, there's a component element to what we're doing, which is, you know, the Edible Park Sculpture Garden, the Soil Science Center, the Permaculture Garden, the Innovation Hub, and the Makerspace. you know, like I mentioned earlier, we are on railroad land, and, you know, they've been a good partner for us, you know, and they're our landlord today. And, you know, if all things come together, maybe we can buy the land from them, which there's some hope that that's possible. And again, context, you know, the railroad has done a lot to help build this country to what it is today. It's also done a lot to tear it apart, you know, sometimes dividing communities, sometimes, you know, being a part of picking winners and losers by where one stop is versus the other, the distribution of resources, right? And one of the real exciting things I've seen the railroad do in the last, and I say the railroad collectively, all railroads, right, is the Rails to Trails program. And what that is it's a program that's taking, you know, abandoned or orphaned land that has been owned, you know, or controlled by the railroad sometimes for, you know, over 100 years, and putting it back to communities for restoration, for trails, for other things. And what we hope is, you know, if the REAP Center goes the way it seems to be, where we can create this resilience hub and this technology and innovation center, that we can further partner with the railroads to roll these out in every major watershed, you know, air quotes, watershed, or bioregion in the country. And the reason I mentioned that opposed to saying one in every state is, you know, we want to exist with the natural world in a way that it makes sense. And the things that are taught in Omaha in terms of land management and ecosystem restoration is going to be very different than what's taught in Tallahassee, right? And so we want to look at interacting with the natural world in that way. But yes, these are scalable solutions that we can roll out for science centers and innovation. And also, you know, there's talk of climate core in, you know, the United States today. There's going to be a need to have an army of people brought in to do restoration projects for the environment, to teach and train the conversion of monoculture tilled ag land into permaculture practices, which actually can be healthier and more profitable for farmers and healthier for the earth. We'll talk about that on another podcast. But yeah, this is something that we do hope to get right here first and then roll out other places if that's what makes sense, right? If communities in those other places see the model and thinks it makes sense for them, then it would be nice to move in and provide them with the resources to grow their own center like we have today.
What's something that keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up at night is, you know, I sometimes wonder, am I on the right seat on the bus? I am a co-founder in this project, but I also started this thing. I mean, a lot of these ideas came out of my head. And, you know, some might simplify my answer here with, oh, this is just imposter syndrome. You know, we all wonder if we're supposed to be in the role that we're in, you know. But, you know, as I look at all the things I'm learning and coming to understand about the intersectionality of social, racial, and environmental justice, and, you know, much of the harm that's been created in the world, you know, a lot of that's been done by people who look a lot like me. And so one thing I struggle with is, you know, if times are changing where maybe my role is to create space for others, you know, am I in the right seat? Should I be the person leading this thing? For now I am. But I want to remain forever conscious about, as I talk about transitioning policy to make smarter changes for the environment, there'll be a time for me to transition to another seat on the bus as well. And I just want to remain open to that. And, you know, that's a real identity thing that I struggle with. But for now, you know, we press on and I looking for a place to be helpful. And this is where I've landed in the context of climate. But I don't want to ever be complacent to somehow think that I've got the answers, because I'll tell you right up front, I don't. I'm seeking to be on a journey with others also looking for those answers. And at some point, we're going to come across somebody who is better suited to be in the seat where I'm sitting today, and they probably won't look like me. They probably will be a different gender than me. And you know what? Like, that's okay. I'm excited for that day. But, you know, I also have to eat. And so I'm trying to figure out, like, when is that transition time, and what is that balance, and what does that look like, and what is abundance? And so those are the things really that keep me up at night. And I knew you were going to ask that question, and I hadn't planned on answering it in this way, but that's how I feel.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the humility in saying that you don't have all the answers is something that unfortunately we don't have a lot of in this world as well. I think there's an incredible kind of profound humility in curiosity, just in general. The fact that we are excited by the fact that we don't have all the answers. We will never in our lives know the answers to everything, because the pursuit of knowledge creates new questions. And that is something that is incredibly exciting for me. And that gives me hope, the fact that there's so much to learn that there's no way that I could possibly learn it all. And that there's so much out there to fill our lives with wonder, that there's no possible way that I could ever get to the end of that. That's exciting for me. That might be scary for some folks, but that's incredibly exciting for me. And just to kind of look on the other side of that coin for a minute, considering everything we've talked about today and everything we didn't get a chance to get to today, what brings you hope? What inspires hope in you for the future, not only of your pursuits, but of the bigger picture of our world?
Oh, it's in the brilliance of young people. For me, having a chance to start working with young minds and just even open myself up to, you know, young folks that I have never met that are part of things like the Sunrise Movement and other stuff. The awareness and the awakening, from a social and an ecological perspective, is so incredibly inspiring. And I see just a wave coming that is so incredibly different in the mindset we've had so far that got us into a lot of the problems that we're in today. And so, you know, it's all a matter of time, but I'm incredibly hopeful by the innovation capabilities of the younger generation that's finding their voice. And I'm just humbled by it on a regular basis. And that gives me hope. And ultimately, that's who I hope to serve, you know, the future generations. It's what gives me hope, and it's what gets me up every morning.
Yep, I completely agree. It's the same for me as well. Just that knowledge that we are stewards waiting for that next generation to be able to you know, hold down the ship long enough that they can work their wonders, they can work their magic, and that we can hopefully be there to support them when that time comes. I think that's awesome. Well, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating conversation today, and hopefully folks have plenty of questions that will get them out there looking into all of these different things that we've talked about. If they want to learn more about you and the work that you're doing, what's the best way for them to do that?
You know, great question. We spend so much time focused on the land and the community. We don't spend as much time on the digital side of things as we could or should as an org. So, but, you know, going to, you know, reapcenter.org is one way to follow us. You know, finding us on the Reap Center at Instagram is another way. Reaching out to me directly, I'm Jonathan DeLong. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. All the ways, there's ways to find me. So reach out, find me. I'll get you connected, or the other ones that I mentioned. But, you know, the truth is, you know, follow along with us. But the best way to get connected is to find the people locally in your communities who are working on regenerative ag projects, who are working on soil health and soil science. They do exist in your local community. Look around, find them. And if you don't find them, reach out to us for resources, and we will help you start something regionally in your area, because it's incredibly important.
Fantastic. Well, we'll have links to as many of those as we can in our show notes. You can check those out at enduringcuriosity.org. We'll have everything that you need to find Jonathan and to learn as much as you can about everything we've talked about today there. Thank you so much, Jonathan. This has been fantastic.
Spectacular. Thank you.
If you're interested in learning about anything we talked about on the show today, please check out the show notes at enduringcuriosity.org. Curiosity is the greatest gift from our childhood. Join us again in 2 weeks as we continue our exploration of restoring our world through regeneration. Until then, I'm your host, Greg Outer. See you next time.